Good morning, diners and travelers and all you people who love to have a good time.
Oh, okay. We have a different entry this
morning.
Well,
yeah, but you're listening to Ann and Peter Haig on the menu. And we're going to start out with Peter introducing an item. There's something happening everywhere at every single minute, probably a million things at every single second.
And we just found out about it, and it's a program that's actually sort of partway through already, but that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of opportunity for you to participate. The famous Brooklyn Brewery, a great leader in the craft beer movement in these United States.
He's
I think on his second year of a program called the Mash by Brooklyn Brewery, which involves Brooklyn Brewery traveling to cities around the world and celebrating beer with food and beer and food and beer. And in this case, it's called the Brooklyn Brewery Mash. Turns out we discovered it's coming to our home city of Pittsburgh, starting June 21st through June 28th. It runs for a whole week. Then guess what? The next stop is London, starting on the 26th of July. The next stop after that, coming back to the United States, is the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Then September 27th in Philadelphia.
It's
in Boston on October 11th.
How about a website?
Oh, yeah. It's it's really simple. It's Brooklyn Brewery Mash. Brooklyn Brewery, MASH.com. No punctuation in there except the dot before the .com.
So interested people can check their cities to see if they're going to have this event arriving.
The ones I mentioned are going to recap again. London on the 26th of July, Minnesota on the 9th of August, Philadelphia on the 27th of September, Boston on the 11th of October, 25th of October in Miami, and then Austin, Texas, finishing off the program on the 15th of November. So it's quite a swing. And the co-founder, Stephen Hindy, the co-founder of Brooklyn Brewery, he's going to be there. He apparently just published a new book called The Craft Beer Revolution. He's going to be working with several of the outlets for microbrews here in the Pittsburgh area, like Church Brew Works.
Do we have that book? I don't remember.
Not that I know of.
We better look.
So you've just got to get all this information because if you're into craft beer, Brooklyn Brewery is one of the leaders, and they're working with a whole wide variety of people. Two interesting events in particular. There's going to be one out on a farm. I'm just trying to read the information here. Who and what? Andrew Gerson, who's the corporate chef for Brooklyn Brewery. Apparently they have a corporate chef. He's going to be at the Market District on October 21st. He's going to be at Industry Public House on Butler Street, and then dinner on a farm on Sunday, June 22nd. And then a particularly interesting event that we are planning to go to is a mystery dinner. A slow supper big table with chefs Andrew Gerson and Kate Romaine from local restaurant E2. And it's a surprise location. We won't find out where we're going until the day of the event. And that's on Thursday, June 26th. So get more information at the website that I told you about. Again, it's brooklynbrewerymash.com. And now, having done that, why don't we get on with today's program?
Well, I was wondering when we're going to get on today's program.
It's already on the website. We have to provide a lot of good information here.
Right.
And we're
going to jump back to our interviews from our most recent visit to NOLA, New Orleans, Louisiana, starting with a new restaurant by an old favorite chef.
Well, I actually kept two together because of the juxtaposition. There's a $5 word, if you like. The juxtaposition of new and old, I thought, was really very interesting. So leading off, Alan Shire of Domenica Restaurant and Pizza Domenica, which is what he's going to talk to us most about, is one of the new breed, the new group of chefs who once again are proving that New Orleans, Louisiana cuisine is some of the best in the country. In fact, some of the best in the world.
We actually fell in love with Alon Shire. I don't remember, Alon, how many years ago, but the first time we tasted any of the food you cooked at Domenica, we were sold on your talents. You are not like one of the we interview a lot of New Orleans chefs who have been here and their families have been here for 15 generations. You are not one of those. You have a more varied background. Tell, just refresh our listeners' memory about that.
Born in Israel, and when I was 4 years old, my family immigrated to Philadelphia. And that's where I grew up until I went to culinary school at the age of 18 in New York at the Culinary Institute of America. But I have been in Louisiana now for close to 12 years. And I feel like anyone that's kind of survived Katrina and stayed and continued to enjoy life here is an honorary local. And so I consider myself a local here in New Orleans because I really do love the city so much, and I love the culture, and I love the people, and I love where it's been and what I've kind of endured, what it's gone through Katrina, and am really proud of where the city is today.
Now, your talent has been influenced, or your tastes have been influenced greatly by the time you spent in Italy. Tell us where that was and when and how long.
Well, I spent a year in Italy, and I went out there with the help of Chef Mark Vetri and Jeff Benjamin in Philadelphia. They were kind enough to refer me to a restaurant out there, and I went and started working in Bergamo, foot of the Italian Alps in northern Italy. I spent a few months in Bergamo. And then just through making connections while I was living out there, I met a family in Parma that I fell in love with that cured meats, made culatello, made salami, also had a restaurant, and I went to work for them for the remainder of the year where I rolled pastas and baked breads, and just really just fell in love with Italian culture and Italian food and the people and the music and everything that makes that country so special and so beautiful. I then came back to New Orleans and then couldn't stay away. I moved back to Italy for another few months to go and make pizzas with a friend in Parma as well.
Well, that gives us a clue as to why your first restaurant, New Orleans Domenica, is Italian-inspired, and the food there is beautiful, a bit more upscale than where we are now, which is an offshoot, and it's in a different location altogether, and it's Domenica Pizza. Tell us a little bit about this restaurant.
Thank you. So the pizzas that we serve at Domenica have become so popular that we ended up making, we forecasted to cook maybe about 100 pizzas a day there when we opened it, and we're now up to about 500 pizzas a day. And so the pizza became so popular that we decided to open up this restaurant that we call Pizza Domenica. And it is centered around pizzas, a lot of which we serve at Domenica, but also a few other ones. And we also have other fun items like wood roasted octopus and garlic knots, and we've added a variety of things to this menu here that are more casual and fun and oriented to be shared, which has been very popular so far.
Let's back up a little. The look here is very different. I love this look. I mean, you have crystal chandeliers, but also non-crystal chandeliers, recycled, reclaimed wood, and the heart of the place, of course, is your wood-fired oven. Talk to us about it.
So when I designed Pizza Domenica, I really wanted it to feel like a neighborhood place. I wanted it to feel warm. I wanted people that could come and really just enjoy spending a couple hours drinking different beers and wines and eating pizza. And so we used a lot of the warm colors of the reclaimed wood, firewood in the dining room that's on display that we used to actually throw into the wood-burning oven to make our pizzas, and a lot of copper tones and leather tones. And that's where the restaurants really come together beautifully, to where it feels good at 11:30 in the morning if you're just here for a quick lunch, but it also feels great at 11:30 at night when you want to hang out with some friends and drink craft beers and really just kind of relax. And I'm so happy with the way that this restaurant makes you feel.
Now, you mentioned the beers. he got away. Your manager responsible for the beer program, or the actual bar program. It's really an interesting program. Can you talk a little bit about the wines, beers, and spirits?
Sure. So our general manager is Stephen Jeffcoat, and he is really passionate about all beverage things. But he's put together this beautiful list of about 40 different wines, all served by the glass, all from Italy. We also have 12 beers on tap on a glycol-chilled beer tap system, which give us really cold beers. Some of them are small kegs from microbrews in Italy, like Super Baladin and Brewfist. And then a lot of them are local beers, like the Southern Prohibition from Mississippi. We have Abita here from Louisiana. And then also some beers from Texas and stuff like that, like the St. Arnold beer. And then he has another 30 or so beers by the can or by the bottle that are truly artisan beers that are super good and are from all over the world. We have a great whiskey and bourbon selection. We have about 12 different gins that we offer. We have a large amount of Amaros and Grappa that we offer. And all that, you know, is to create an atmosphere to make you want to stick around and grab another drink and eat another pizza and feel comfortable. That's really the goal for this place, is to be that neighborhood spot where mom and dad can come eat some snapper crudo or a smoked grouper salad, and the kids could have a pepperoni pizza, and everyone can be happy, and mom can enjoy a really beautiful glass of white wine while the son or daughter has a great soda. And that's kind of what we wanted to achieve.
We talked briefly a little bit ago about how the big news is how in love current contemporary chefs are with fire. And boy, I can smell the wood burning in this place, which also adds to the comfort factor of the restaurant. Tell me your fascination with fire.
Well, as a chef, there's something very gratifying about being able to light a piece of wood on fire and then ending up with a gorgeous pizza or roasted fish or steak. I think inside all of us is this appreciation for how cooking started. And of course, burning wood is the original way to cook anything. And I love how not only the flavor that it imparts, but also when you really truly learn how to work the wood burning oven, you learn that you gain so much control over how you're able to cook food, and you're able to reach heights with the food that you're cooking that you can't necessarily do with gas or electric. And our pizzas are a perfect example to get that beautiful blistered look where you have all these small little char spots. That is impossible to do in another type of oven. You need the burning wood. You need that orange glow to create that look. And that's one thing that when I speak with my cooks about how do we properly cook our pizzas, I always say you want to see the glow in the oven. You got to see that orange hue and that color, because without that, you don't have the right type of fire going to perfectly blister your pizzas. And so it becomes cooking as an art form with this something that's alive. You know, I think like burning wood, I consider it alive, and there's this relationship between the cook and the fire. And if you can control the fire properly, you can control how your food's going to look. And when all that comes together, it's a super gratifying feeling.
You don't disdain contemporary cooking methods, though. I mean, this wonderful cauliflower we had, you sous-vide-ed it. Is that a verb? I'm not even sure. You cooked it with sous-vide to start with. And then you put it to the fire.
Yeah, our wood-burning oven serves also as a cauliflower cooker. We serve close to 100 heads of cauliflower a day between both restaurants. But first, what we do is we take the whole head of cauliflower, and we vacuum seal it with butter and olive oil and lemon and salt and chili flakes. And then we sous-vide it until the cauliflower is perfectly cooked all the way through. but still has a little bite to it. After that, it gets chilled, and then it goes into our wood-burning oven at 800 degrees to get charred all over, and it comes out this really deep golden color. That is the beauty of that fire, that we can actually get this really even golden char color over onto the entire head of cauliflower. But it does take a combination of a little bit of modern cooking and some old school method of cooking.
And I must say that we're going to talk in a little bit about what you put with these dishes, which your creations, but Peter wants to say something.
Okay, listeners, so have you ever eaten a garlic knot? The answer is you probably haven't. Have you ever eaten a clam pizza? You probably haven't. These are just some of the inventions that Alan has created here. Tell us a little bit more about this thought process that says you can create these delicious new things.
Well, thank you, Peter. I claim to be the inventor of a clam pizza, but we do this great pizza that we take the pizza dough and we rub it with Parmigiano Reggiano and roasted garlic oil and chili flakes and Sicilian oregano. We cook that in the wood-burning oven. And then to order, we cook the clams with a little bit of white wine and lemon and butter. And as the clams open up, they release their beautiful clam juice, and all that kind of cooks down together. And when the pizza comes out of the oven, we pour those clams with all their natural juices and the wine and the butter all over the top of the pizza. And that combination of crispy pizza crust with just cooked clams and butter really makes me super happy every time I eat it. The garlic knots are, you know, it almost seems like a no-brainer that we have all this great pizza dough, but we want to do something where we're not getting completely bored all the time of making the same thing over and over again. So the garlic knots, we cut the pizza dough after we roll it out. We tie it in a knot. We roast it in the wood-burning oven, and then it gets tossed in this salsa verde with cilantro and parsley and lemon zest and chili flakes and extra virgin olive oil. And we serve that with a roasted garlic fonduta, which is essentially a roasted garlic whipped cream that has aged provolone mixed into it. And when you take those garlic knots and dip it into that aged provolone and roasted garlic whipped cream, it's an amazing combination of texture.
It's the sort of thing, after you've tasted it, you'll want to have some so you can put some on your cornflakes in the morning.
Actually, I said I was going to do that. I think I said Cheerios. How many different kinds of pizzas do you have?
We currently have 19 pizzas on the menu, and we definitely work very hard on shopping at the farmer's market and getting local seasonal produce. And so you'll see a pizza right now with fava beans and artichokes and spring onions. And then we have pizzas that we've created through the years that people have really just come to love, like the wild mushroom pizza with a cracked egg right in the middle of it. And as it cooks, the egg yolk stays runny, but the whites cook. And that's a great combination of caramelized mushrooms and caramelized onions and smoked Alan Benton's bacon, and then that egg right in the middle. That's one of my favorite. And then we have the classics like the margarita, and we make a pepperoni pizza for all the kids that come in, and they love that. But then we have some fun, and we do a pizza with like roasted carrots and pickled beets and Brussels sprouts and goat cheese, which is surprisingly really amazing. It sounds like there's a lot going on, but the flavors come together really, really beautifully.
Well, you know, too bad I didn't live in New Orleans, because I would like to try all of these different pizzas. No way to do that today. You also served us some, what was it, the octopus, the wood-roasted octopus. And I had to comment on that because it was such a perfect balance of flavors, and including acidity. What's in the roasted octopus?
So we slow cook octopus and then take that and caramelize it in the oven. And that gets served with potatoes and jalapeno. We put a little sherry vinegar in there for the acid. And we use isot chili, which is a really beautiful chili that comes from the Mediterranean that has hints of chocolate in the flavor. And all that gets served with this celery leaf and radish salad on top. And that the way all that comes together with the iced hot chili and the roasted octopus and the crispy potatoes and jalapeno is super, super tasty. And everything that we cook that is served hot comes out of that wood-burning oven. And that's another, as a chef, it was hard to say, I'm not going to have a deep fryer. I'm not going to have a grill. I'm not going to have a six-burner range. We've really said, all we're going to have is this wood-burning oven. And anything that we serve hot in the restaurant is going to come out of that oven. Limited us in what we can serve, but it's at the same time pushed our creativity to say, how do we use that oven in ways that we've never thought of before? And how can we make a great frittata in there? How do we make a great prosciutto, potato, and fontina cast iron skillet in there? You know, like there's all these things that we can now kind of push ourselves to learn how to cook now that we have only one piece of cooking equipment in the kitchen. We make sausage in there. We roast vegetables in there. And it's become a lot of fun and a challenge at the same time.
Well, I think by now everybody's really drooling. I think you understand this is simple, straightforward, but pretty sophisticated stuff. I think, Alon, let people know where exactly this restaurant is.
It's located at 4933 Magazine Street, which is in Uptown New Orleans. It's about a 10-minute drive south of the downtown Central Business District or the French Quarter in New Orleans. On the website is pizzadominica.com.
Now, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that there will be another one of these at some point in the future. We just opened this one. So down the line, there will be another Pizza Domenica, and I'm crossing my fingers that we will also hit on a grand Israeli restaurant down the line, and you agree that this is in the works at some point in the future.
One of my dreams is definitely to open a restaurant that I can serve the foods that I grew up eating as a child and that my mother and my grandmother cooked their entire lives. And so I definitely want to cook Israeli food in a restaurant at some point. I'm just not sure exactly when that's going to happen yet. But the wheels are turning in the head, and I'm working on figuring out how all that can come together.
Well, we're churning, waiting, and we'll be there. And we certainly enjoy seeing you every time we do see you and love your food. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And if Alon Shire at Pizza Domenica is new wave, right after the break, Antoine's restaurant is certainly old wave, but still going strong after 174 years. So we'll be talking with them right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Every time I venture again into Antoine's, I get catch in my throat, although not ever enough to keep me from eating too much. It is an incredible institution in New Orleans, and we're going to be talking to Michael Gregoire, which senior, I might say, because there is a junior. And you've actually been a chef here for 41 years?
Well, I worked at Antoine's for 41 years. I was appointed executive chef 11 years ago. And, you know, at one point, John DeVille and I were co-chefs for at least 15 years together. And John retired, then that's when I stepped up to executive chef. Instead of having a co-chef, they went down to one.
Well, now you figured out at an early age that you liked food, particularly New Orleans food, because you can count at least three generations into New Orleans, although there's probably a lot more, right?
You know, when you say that, absolutely, you know. And then as a young guy coming up, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. at one point in the time, I delivered refrigeration, and my grandfather was a cook at this place called Stephen and Martin's. And when he came up to do it, it was a po' boy shop. Really, it was called Martin Brothers. And I decided that I got into cooking, and naturally, like any other family, we had family recipes. My grandmother, my mother, they're all great cooks. So I kind of wanted to follow that. And, I worked a little bit in the kitchen with my mom and my grandmother. And then when I had the opportunity to come to New Orleans, to Antoine's, when I came here, I was actually doing seafood, like balling seafood, things in the back. So I really learned from the bottom up. And it got to the point where it was great because I started understanding what I was doing. You know, in the beginning, you had no idea. But then, I figured it out.
Well, when I say this is an institution, I'm not just throwing words around. Next year, Antoine's will be celebrating its 175th anniversary, and it is in the same family and in continuous operation as a restaurant since its founding. I don't know of another place like that.
Yes, we are. We're in 175-year anniversary. I've been in this restaurant for 41 years of it. The family that owns the restaurant, it's like we have a lot of longevity here. They're actually good people to work for. The restaurant is very interesting. When you work in restaurants and you're a restaurant this size and that, they really understand what it's about, what food's about, and how to, handle people. And with all that said and done, it's a good, great place to work.
Now, the menu here, I mean, we're really talking old standards. I mean, the food is, everything's totally up to perfect execution, but you're not into novelty dishes. In fact, what novelties there might be considered on the menu were invented here a great many years ago. Tell us about some of those.
Antoine's, we really out in the things that we do here. And Oysters Rockefeller is an item that we created. And we have an oyster fish. It's another dish that we also created. Those two, just on the oyster level itself. And then we also have, right now we have alligator soup. Years ago, alligator soup was turtle soup. And it got to the point where turtles started to get extinct. They stopped you from killing them or buying them. So then we decided we're going to go with something else. We went with an alligator. And it really works well. Now, one thing we blessed with in this restaurant and in the city itself is the abundance of seafood. We have some, and you was talking about, and we do things here that I guess you want to call it old school. I guess you want to call it things that, we do have specials that we create new dishes. But you can come to Antoine's that you've been here 70 years ago and still have an aubergine, still have a filet, still have a pompano. We don't really change those type of things. And the way we change things, with specials. We run, daily specials all the time.
I mean, I suspect that if, in fact, you took some of these classics off the menu, you'd have a revolution on your hands. And I notice you have a lot of people coming through just for the history of the place on tours. And you've served food to how many luminaries? Mention some of the interesting people that you've fed here.
Well, when you say interesting, in 1987, we served the Pope. And we served the Pope, and it wasn't served at the restaurant. We went to the Archbishop's home on Callaghan Street. It was four chefs and about six different waiters. And we served them for 3 days. Then we served Nicolas Cage, and we served five presidents. We had a share of serving a lot of dignitaries and important people. And I also made, years ago, I had for a prince, I made a souffle, a creamy souffle, that I thought was okay and he thought it was wonderful. So that worked out well.
Your souffle potatoes, I mean, I could dream of those. I've been eating those most of my life. What's your secret?
Well, what people don't understand about souffles, for one, it's the potato. We use an Idaho Burbank potato, and then you have to let it age. If it doesn't age, potato carries too much sugar in it. And then we cut an eighth of an inch thick, then we put it in a water bath. And in that water bath, It also wash the potato and take the starches off of it. And then what we do, now, just like any other thing, it's a dangerous job because it's, I mean, it's grease and oil. Don't mix. And the first pot that we cook them in a 350. And it really, you feel, just like any other fried product, it will rise to the top. And you actually feel the potato, and it's got a little roughness to it. Then we pop it in 425 grease, and that would actually make it blow. That's something that you have to really watch, because if the person is not doing it, is not careful, you know, it could cause a really dangerous fire. And we modify these pots. We buy a black ons pot, and we put a colander on it, and we put also restrainers, like, just to hold it, because it comes real heavy. But it's something that, it's a product that takes more than one to do. It takes a guy to slice the potatoes. It takes a guy to order the potatoes. It takes a guy to cook the potatoes and serve them. So it's something that really, it's labor intense, but the reward is what we, you know, we're looking for.
Let's talk numbers a little bit here. And now a lot of people were just going through on tours, which I didn't know you did, but how many people actually are seated here? And how many people are in your kitchen and on your wait staff?
When you say how many people are seated here, it depends upon the time of the year. During Mardi Gras, we have a Proteus Monday that we seat about 1,300 people at one time. And this is between 11 to 2 o'clock. And during that time, my staff is 43. That's cooks and dishwashers. And on wait staff, waiters, we have about 38 waiters, and each waiter carries their bus person. But naturally, on that day, normally I have probably somewhere around 16 people in the kitchen at night on a good night. But on a day like that, I also carry extra staff upstairs just to get them out quick, because then I use a dual kitchen. I use upstairs kitchen and downstairs.
We're sitting now. This is like just one little aspect of how everything Antoine's does is like a special, as large as it is, a special niche. We're sitting in the escargot room. What does that mean?
The escargot room is a club. It's a club of eateries. And what we, on the wall, there's there's an escargot up there. And every year, we have what we call an escargot feast. Now, the feast itself is 12 members, and each member is allowed to bring one guest. So there's 24 people on this party, and each year they will come to the, and they also take a napkin. They would take like 30 napkins, and they would inscribe on the napkin. They bring it to the artist, and for each year they would put a little bit about what we're going to do, their meal, the things that went on. Yeah, the escargot room, you know, like I said, they take napkins and they put the, you know, dates on it, and they put the meal on it, plus they put the members. And they pick new, and the members stay the same, unless it's get to the point where it's time for them, and they have a new member they put up, and each year they get to, like I said, they get to invite a guest.
Well, this is amazing. I had two questions. One is, what's your favorite thing to cook? Two, what's your favorite thing to eat?
Well, when you say what's your favorite thing to cook, I don't really have a favorite thing to cook. What makes me, when you say what's favorite, I like to make sauces. I like gravies. I like seafood. And when somebody says, what do you, my favorite thing to eat, I am a gravy person. Like I said, I like simple things at home. I do like baked chicken with a gravy with it. I'm not too much of a meatball and spaghetti man, but I do like a coubillon. I do like beef stew, things like that. And I'm a mashed potato lover.
I'm with you with the mashed potatoes. Potatoes are my most favorite food. And of course your souffle potatoes are just incredible. Yeah, I mean, one of the ways that Antoine originally made a mark was he introduced sauces, French sauces particularly, into this menu, which was a new thing for New Orleans, and nobody's ever tired of it. This is true. Where do you see this going? I mean, have you already trained somebody to pick up and know all this stuff? Because everybody's going to want to have the same food perfectly executed, as you have done for so long.
When you talk about that, yes, I do have several sous chefs that does sauces, that understands what we do. And yes, Antoine's has classical French sauces that we brought into, you know, your Marinara sauce, your cream sauces, and we make a Marchand Vin sauce, which is a red wine sauce that goes over meat. And those are sauces that we're really proud of. And then we have to, you know, we also have, like, when you're talking about Oyster Rockefeller, we have an Oyster Bienville, which is a bechamel sauce. You know, it's got mento and it's got wine in it. And it's a, you know, we actually serve an item we call it 222, and it's two Rockefellers, two Thermidors on it, which is a red sauce, and then two Bienville, which is yellow sauce. And I have several guys in the back, and just like any other place, I cross-train as much as I can because of those reasons, because if this person goes on vacation, I don't want somebody else to come and fill in and actually do, because, I mean, what makes a restaurant go is that you're consistent. You have to be consistent on what you do. And fine diners or people that dine out that or came to Antoine's more than once, they understand that, you know, this sauce is not what I had before. And that's not what you're looking for. You're not looking for, you're looking for, this is just like I remembered it. And that's what we try to do here.
I have one last question. I've been coming here for a great many years. This is the first time I've ever seen people coming in to the restaurant in shorts, cutoffs, and not very well attired. Did you make a conscious decision to drop dress codes?
Well, the thought about that is that when I first came to Antoine's, you're right. You know, you had to wear a coat. You had to have this. You had to have that. And in this, it seemed like people more and more went to leisure ways. People would actually go on conventions and that. And for some reason, they didn't bring. That's why we used to supply jackets for them. They didn't bring jackets to go to conventions with them. And when they went to come into a restaurant like Antoine's, we would actually have coats, and they would use that. And the dress code got more lenient because of the crowd itself. The walking, you know, just like any other place, you want to try to get as many patrons in a place you can. And more people walk in the streets, especially in the summer. They're not in there with a coat. They're not in there with it's too hot. So what we do, we actually let them in with shorts, no thongs. You know, it's got to have shoes, not slippers. And like their blouse, we really want them to have something that you know, like covers, not sleeveless. But it seems like it's relaxed a little more, doesn't it? You know, what we try to do at one time, we try to separate the dresses from the non-dresses. And that worked for a little bit, but then people said, well, I don't want to sit in the front room. I want to sit in the back room. I want to see all the, like you was talking about, the history. They want to walk around a restaurant. They want to read the history that was on the wall. So, more and more we got a little lenient with that. Some people do get offended by it, but it's one of those things that you have to move with time.
Now, listeners, just in case you're wondering, Anne's really quite dressed up. Peter's wearing jeans, but he is wearing a jacket. Now, when we went to Commander's Palace one time, we had to wait for a jacket to be available so we could have lunch. So I think we're glad you changed. It's a recognition that I guess Antoine's moves slowly with the times, but certainly still moves. And it's been just a wonderful pleasure to come back here again after not having been here for at least a decade and find out that what's on the plate hasn't changed one little bit. You could always count on it, and we enjoyed ourselves today, didn't we, sweetheart?
I loved it. And as I said, I mean, it's a happy place for me because I've had so many happy times here. And thank you so much for providing us with all that. And do you want to say one last thing?
Well, just want to thank you. You know, I want to thank you. And I know, like we was talking about the 175th anniversary. Yes, we're going to have a party, and we're going to post that when it's going to happen. Come see us.
We were already invited, so don't disinvite us.
And we'll be back with another great chef and another great culinary subject right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
and just asked me what's a new culinary subject. and the answer goes something like this: Cathal Armstrong.
Yes,
he's an Irish chef. But
he's charming because he's Irish.
He has a great restaurant in the Washington D.C. area, I think in Alexandria, Virginia, called Eve. Yep. So we talked to him about that, but mostly we talked to him about his new cookbook, My Irish Table.
I think that we may have overwhelmed you a little bit. We're talking to Cathal Armstrong, and his new book is My Irish Table. He has a number of restaurants. I guess the flagship is probably Restaurant Eve. And then the other one, which is named after your son. And you're going to have to tell me the name.
That's Eamon's, a Dublin chipper.
Yep. And you have... Yeah. Yeah. And then you have sort of spin-offs from all those all over the place, right?
Yeah, we have Society Fair, which is a gourmet store, food emporium, wine bar, bread, bakery, butcher. Mm-hmm. And then we have The Majestic, which is a casual American neighborhood restaurant that's actually been in Alexandria in some form since the 1930s.
Well, the book that we're talking to you about is My Irish Table, Recipes from the Homeland. And, of course, everybody knows the homeland is Ireland, and Restaurant Eve. I think when I started to say we probably overwhelmed you, you weren't expecting people who are totally enthralled with Irish chefs and Irish cuisine, were you? Was that a surprise?
No, but it's an awful lot of people are surprised that Irish cuisine, that the word Irish and cuisine can be put side by side. That tends to be the majority of people that don't really know that there is a great cuisine blossoming in Ireland, but it's occasional that you come across somebody who's been there and has had the awakening like yourself and seen how beautiful it can be.
Well, of course, you were the same as could be said about British cooking. Talk about oxymorons, and yet London's one of the great food cities in the world now.
Yeah, well, I had to put up with that. I had to put up with people mocking me about that for years.
I think
you probably had the same experience too, and it turns out to be a rubbish idea because of the efforts of individuals. But there's a second ingredient, I think, in Ireland, which is a huge part of the success, which is the magnificent larder that you have available to you there, which is less available in a more built up country like Britain.
Right. Yeah, we have tremendous access to the raw materials to produce a cuisine. You know, I mean, the fact that it's a tiny island is very advantageous, and all the seafood that we have available, the Dublin Bay prawns, and there's a tremendous amount of history of the salmon in our mythology and in our history. The lobsters from the North Atlantic coast, and the Galway Bay oysters are magnificent.
Yes.
You know, so there's so many building blocks to a cuisine that it's almost, unless you understand the history of Ireland, it's hard to understand how it never really had an opportunity to develop in the past.
Right. Now, you had, I would say, from the point of view of somebody who was going to become an important chef, you had a really privileged background growing up there.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know, like, people tend to equate privilege with wealth, and I don't, we certainly weren't a wealthy family. We, for a period of my upbringing, we were definitely well fixed in the middle class. And my father had a successful business, and then some regulations were changed, in the travel trade in Europe, and he went out of business almost overnight, and, from being quite comfortable to being stretched to pay the bills for a couple of years until he reestablished himself and started a new business. But I was privileged in the sense that he loved and still loves and was very passionate about food. And he also has had a hobby of growing everything that he could in the back garden in our house in the south side of Dublin. So, you know, with his love for food and his passion for growing, we had some of the finest ingredients and some of the best cooking that you could possibly imagine. And there were so, so many times when we, the eight of us would be sitting around the table and Dad would say, nobody else in Ireland is eating this tonight. And it was no exaggeration.
Now, your mum was in there too, right?
Yeah, my mother would have cooked a more casual style of food. And, like, it's funny, so she, my mother never tasted garlic until she married my father. And that would have been really typical in Ireland at the time. They had, you know, through the 60s and the 70s, the economy was poor and people weren't really exposed to foods the way they are in you know, with the advent of the internet and the information age. They just didn't really know that such a thing existed, you know. So garlic would have been considered to be very exotic for most people in Ireland.
Peter's
that
mother would think that too.
I have news for you. My mother passed away last year at age 96, and as far as she knew, she never ate garlic in her whole life. Now that's really not true, because every time she came to our house, she did.
But she didn't know it,
and if she'd known it was in there, she would have turned her nose up at it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I have a very good friend who's from County Cork, and he is, you know, a simple country fella and a great friend of mine, and he thinks he's allergic to garlic. But I have fed him pounds and pounds of garlic over the years, so if he is allergic, he should have died a long time ago.
That's a common claim, you know, the people who don't or think they don't like garlic say they're allergic to it. Chefs complain about that all the time.
We find it fairly common that people get heartburn from eating raw garlic, and that they think that that's an allergy.
I see. Well, now, we're skipping over this part where you were shipped off to France for your summers as an exchange student. Now, that would have exposed you to a lot.
Yeah, and that was, like, such a great experience. My 12-year-old son, I sent him on a trip to New York there a couple of months ago, and it was the first time that he'd been away from the home without his parents. And, you know, his mother was crying. And but the first time, the funny thing is, the first time I went to France by myself on an airplane, I was 7 years old. And my mother just put me on the plane and said, off you go. And I landed in Orly Airport, because Charles de Gaulle wasn't the international airport in those days. And not a word of French in my head. And had to find my way to this family that I was doing exchange with. But they, like every French family, most French families, they take vacation the first 2 weeks of August, and they went camping all around the French countryside. So we visited places like Normandy, and of course the apples of Normandy and the Camembert, and then into the Loire Valley, and then we visited a goat cheese production.
I notice you've now switched into Irish with a French accent. that's very clever. Now, so back on your mainstream life track.
Yes, sir.
You report very honestly in your book that your first restaurant venture was, shall we say, far from successful.
Yeah, it was a disaster. And,
okay,
and,
that's a nice way of putting it.
The walls were closing in towards the end. The health inspector started to come around, and we had no. We had no permits or health license at all, and you know, I didn't know anything about that, you know, it was a very good learning opportunity. There was a cost associated with it. Obviously, now I'm living in America and not living in Ireland, so that was definitely one of the costs associated with it. But it was an amazing learning experience, and I learned really a good, healthy list of things not to do in the restaurant business.
So what brought you to these shores?
Well, after we closed that restaurant, my parents and I sat down and had a discussion, and we decided that I would come to America, where the streets are paved with gold, and earn some fast cash and get out of the restaurant business and go back to... I was originally thinking of going to Polytech in London.
But that didn't happen.
It didn't really turn out that way. It's really just a great romance in that I met a girl, an American girl, and fell in love with her, and ended up staying here for her mostly. So, and then it was kind of, I at that stage was an illegal immigrant, and I got a green card in the lottery, in the Morrison lottery, and went back to Ireland to swear to pay taxes at the U.S. Embassy in Dublin, and and then came back here and tried to figure out some direction for my life to go in. And like, I had some cooking experience at that stage, but I would certainly not use the word chef or even cook with my name at that stage, because it was just kind of aimlessly working in kitchens without any real plan. But then I met a chef at a restaurant called New Heights, which is in Woodley Park in Washington, D.C., and I went to work for him. His name was Gregory Hill, and he started teaching me good basic fundamentals of cooking, butchering and sauce making and emulsions and pâtés, and, you know, so I almost had an apprenticeship at that stage. And then Greg left New Heights and went to work at a hotel called the Barcelo Hotel, and I went with him there. And I met another chef that he had hired to be the executive sous chef, called Neil Annis, who had a lot of experience working with some of the renowned chefs of Washington, D.C. at the time, like Jeffrey Boubin and Doug McNeil, who was the chef at the Four Seasons.
You went to work for Boubin, right?
Yeah, Neil saw that I had some talent and suggested that if I wanted to be serious about the restaurant business, that I needed to go work for either Doug McNeil or Boubin. And I visited the Four Seasons, and I was just coming off of one hotel and wasn't really excited about the idea of going to work in another hotel, so I decided to go work for Jeffrey Boubin at Vidalia. And I stayed there for about 3.5 years until Jeff opened another restaurant.
Now, he's a very unusual restaurateur and chef because, as I recall, he won a James Beard Regional Chef Award, and then several years later, the chef that he had put in place there, whose name I've forgotten,
R.J. Cooper.
R.J. Cooper, who's actually he's actually from this part of the world, from somewhere near Pittsburgh, and he won a Best Chef Mid-Atlantic at the same restaurant. I think the only other place that's happened is the French Laundry.
Yes, that would be probably correct. Yeah.
Now let's talk about the kinds of recipes that are in this book.
Right.
Some of them are, I would say, traditional Irish. In this section, you say what ma'am cooked, right?
Yeah.
But I can't see that you would have been raised on sardines braised in spicy tomato sauce.
Would not really have eaten fresh sardines at home, but there was plenty of canned sardines. And the section that recipe is in is called Rugby Matches in Croke Park. And that it's kind of snack food that we would have taken to the park to see games, or that we would have eaten at home watching a rugby match, and adopted from the Spanish tapas. And my father had a lot of business in Spain, so there's a slight Spanish influence there. But you know, the canned sardines and the spicy tomato sauce was one of the things that I loved eating up, and you just spread it on toast and so delicious. But I wanted to make it slightly different by using fresh tomatoes and when they're in season, and then fresh sardines, and I think that just, you know, elevates it to a little bit more fancy of a snack.
You know, we used to have that for tea sometimes at home. I never really liked it. And another guy who also had it and recreated a recipe like it was Heston Blumenthal at the Fat Duck.
Right.
I think it's sort of his idea of a joke.
Yeah, because I mean, it was kind of a joke that the sardines in the can was kind of a joke, and I mean, we even made colloquial terms out of being crammed into a car like sardines.
Well, you know, as I read your recipes, they're Irish primarily. I mean, I'm talking not about the traditional, the classical dishes which you relayed, but character of your dishes and your recipes is Irish in the sense of your choice of pristine ingredients, but with a whole lot of other influences put in there. Is that correct?
Yeah, like I wanted the book, when we were originally talking about doing a cookbook, of course, the initial conversation was about doing a Restaurant Eve cookbook. But what we find very often with restaurant cookbooks is that the dishes are complicated. They're designed for a large staff. They're designed for commercial equipment, and they're not really useful to most home cooks. So I, you know, decided that I would look at, to do a Rest on Eve cookbook later, and rather write a book about how I got to Rest on Eve. And so it ends up being a very personal memoir more than anything else, and very nostalgic. Like when I got the first copy of it from the publisher, it almost brought a tear to my eye.
Uh-huh.
Because it reminded me of the stories of my youth, and you can, you know, that way when you're with food of your youth, the memories rush back into your head in such bright colors.
Yeah, they rush back into my head too, but they're more like a nightmare.
Oh yeah, his mother was the all-time worst cook in the whole universe.
I was lucky; I made it out of childhood, but no thanks to the chef. But this
yeah,
is
that was the majority of the kids, you know, from Ireland and England in those days. Like there's a story in there about how I went to stay in a friend's house, and we sat on the floor in front of the television eating bird's eye codfish fingers, and my father would be horrified. I don't think he even knows that story.
Yeah, we used to get those for dinner sometimes too. Never did like them very much. And I always joked later, I wonder what they did with the rest of the cod after they cut off all the fingers.
Well, I mean, I think that you do a lot of good things with potatoes, peas. I love this marrow fat peas recipe.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, well, the marrow fat pea was something that we ate on fairly rarely, but on kind of special occasions. Like it's typically served with the roast beef and the Yorkshire pudding, and the marrow fat peas is a very English tradition. But you would have seen it on a lot of Irish tables at the same time. And the marrow fat peas were peas that were left on the vine to dry in the field. And then you added some baking soda to them, and they became this very mushy. And in my case, although my mother loves them, I never really liked them at all. So I decided, rather than use the traditional marrow fat pea, to make an interpretation of it using marrow fat with the peas, fat.
That's really brilliant. So I remember I used to get marrow fat peas. So marrow fat peas are what they put in mushy peas.
Yes, yeah.
Which is one of the most disgusting substances on earth.
I know, and it's one of those things. It's one of those food things. There are people that love them and people that hate them, and I think the majority are the haters.
Yeah. I didn't realize you can actually get them in a can. We found that out thanks to our niece who served them once, and she never said it was out of cans, but I noticed the cans in the trash.
Right, and they're not any better either in the can.
No, they're not any better, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you remember your mother or your grandmother would have had that box, and they soaked them overnight with the little packet,
the little
tablet that came in the box.
Exactly, it made them look greener.
Right.
I think that's what it was supposed to do.
Still disgusting.
Yeah, exactly. But so this is sort of like a life story in recipes, but at the same time, there are a lot of really fine tips here as to how to go about creating food that's much more interesting than you ordinarily would. And you carefully made it possible by explaining how someone with home cooking skills can do it. This is a book I'm going to use myself because I have no basic training in cooking at all.
Oh.
But I managed to get good stuff on the table. But I'm sure I'm doing a lot of it the wrong way. And I'm going to set about changing my ways now that I have access to your methods of doing things.
You know,
I really try to make it understandable, and we did. You know, one of those things about you often find with cookbooks where you buy them and you get excited about it and you try a recipe and the recipe doesn't work. My co-author David Hagedorn was adamant, and I thank him for his insistence that we test the recipes over and over again in home kitchens. So they all work. With the exception that there was one recipe in the book that I wasn't 100% satisfied that I hit it exactly right, and that's the orange marmalade. But it's close. But the rest of the recipes all have been tested over and over and over again, and I know they work. And we got other people to test them to make sure that, you know, the directions made sense, and that the end result was.
I think that's important. I mean, I did one cookbook with the chef, and nobody tested them outside of his kitchen. And I don't even want to talk to anybody who's tried to make anything from the cookbook.
Well, if after this, listeners, you're fascinated with the idea that this is a chef whose restaurants you might like to go to, He does have a website, restauranteve.com, I believe.
That's right.
And I have a special request before we go off the air. I need a tongue recipe. And I felt sure I would find one in this book, and I didn't find one. Do you have one?
Yeah, I do have a good tongue recipe, and something that is fairly difficult to find in America, but I have found them on the internet. It's called a tongue press. So what I'll do is write a recipe and email it to you, and maybe you want to put it on your website.
Sure, that would be great.
On my website, too, for tongue, which is a really delectable, delicious thing to eat.
Yeah, I have three frozen tongues in our freezer right now, and we have a local butcher who opened a small store. He sells tongues for
$5.
Beef tongues for $5. Can you believe it?
Yeah. You can feed a good family with a tongue.
I'm going to be waiting to hear from you before I start working on those, but I'm glad to know that there's a place I'll be able to go. And it's been a fascinating life story so far. I'm sure you're going to write many more chapters, and there will be sequels to this book, and there will be more restaurants. So please keep in touch with us and let us know what you're up to. And when we're going back to Ireland again, or you're going back to Ireland again, and again, we have to swap suggestions about where to go.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's all we have for this week's program. Don't forget to find out more about Brooklyn Brewery Mash in your neighborhood, neck of the woods, as Al Roker would say. And between us and you, we hope that we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.